So, good afternoon. I'm Linnea Sandin, the Associate Director and Associate Fellow of the Americas Program here at CSIS, and it is my pleasure to welcome you today. We are very excited to host such a distinguished panel to discuss this timely topic. Last December, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, better known as AMLO, took office in Mexico. He won the presidential election in July 2018 in a landslide victory on a left-wing platform that promised to, among other things, promote the respect of human rights, improve the economy, work to end the ongoing drug war, and address corruption at all levels of government. For many Mexicans, AMLO has represented a paradigm shift from the governance of the past few decades and sees himself as a remedy to ineffective government responses to corruption and violence. Yesterday marked the first anniversary of his inauguration, and during his first year in office, AMLO has enjoyed a record high approval rating. However, in the past year, he has also faced challenges on many fronts, including Mexico's security, economy, and migration this year, and what to expect going forward. Today, I'm joined by four experts. Carlos Bravo Regidor is Associate Professor and Coordinator of the Journalism Program at CIDE, the Center for Economic Research and Teaching in Mexico City. His areas of academic expertise are history and contemporary politics in Mexico and the United States, the bilateral relationship between both countries, and media and journalism. He is also a contributor to various printed media outlets and a commentator on radio and television. Rebecca Bell Chavez is a senior fellow in the Peter D. Bell Rule Program at the Inter-American Dialogue. She served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Western Hemisphere Affairs from 2013 through 2017. Before joining OSD Policy, she was Professor of Political Science with tenure at the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. Her research has focused on Western Hemisphere security and on comparative politics, with an emphasis on the rule of law, democratization, human rights, and Latin American politics. Tony Garasasu is the Regional Director for Latin America and the Caribbean at the International Republican Institute. Before being named as Regional Director, Tony served as the Director of the Center for Global Impact at IRI and oversaw the Institute's programming in Central America, Haiti, and Mexico. Before joining IRI, he served as Director of Business and Government Relations at Globalvia Infrastructures and was the Deputy Director of International Affairs at the Florida Office of Tourism, Trade, and Economic Development. And joining us today by video is Gladys McCormick, the J. and Debbie Moskowitz Endowed Chair on Mexico-U.S. Relations at the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs of Syracuse University, where she focuses on contemporary political and economic history of Latin America, and more specifically, Mexico, corruption, drug trafficking, and political violence. She's also a senior associate here with the CSIS Americas program. So thank you to all of you for being here with us today. So to begin the conversation, Carlos, what was the reason for AMLO's landslide victory last year, and what drew voters to him?
Well, thank you so much for having me. Well, I think that in order to understand the landslide victory of López Obrador, the first thing we need to understand is the fiasco of Peña Nieto's administration. I think there were at least three issues that became very salient and a source of a lot of popular discontent during Peña Nieto's administration. Number one, it was corruption and impunity. Of course, I mean, this is not new, certainly, in Mexican history. But during the Peña Nieto administration, the level of corruption, and particularly the level of public scrutiny regarding corruption and journalistic scandals regarding corruption, reached an unprecedented level. And even, I mean, touched upon the president himself. There was this scandal called Peña Nieto's White House, in which basically a government contractor from when Peña Nieto was governor of the state of Mexico, built a house for Peña Nieto's wife, for Mexico's first lady, of which there was no evidence of payment. And this was bound to become, in many ways, sort of a Mexican Watergate, because the scandal was so big and so infuriating. But you know, with a small difference, with Watergate, it ended up leading to the president's resignation. And in the case of Mexico, it led to the firing of the journalist who had done the research. So that was like an impressive moment in his term. This happened in November of 2014. And from then on, you know, corruption scandals kept on piling up. And there was this sense, you know, that the country was up in flames because of the violence. That would be like the second issue. Between 2011 and 2014, there was actually an important descent in the homicide levels. But from 2014, 2015 on, you know, it resumed, and now it has reached historical levels that Mexico didn't have, even in the worst years of Felipe Calderón. So while that was happening, the sense that, you know, the political class or the governing class was just, you know, like devoted, you know, to corruption, really, you know, ended up becoming a very explosive political mix. And the third ingredient of it, of course, was a very growing and keen sense of injustice, of inequality, because, you know, of very mediocre, you know, economic growth rates. Of poverty, really, poverty has gone down, but you know, very gradually, very slowly, and also with inequality. So there was this sense, I mean, and this was global, of course, it was not only in Mexico, but during the last decade, there's been a keen awareness of injustice in terms of poverty and inequality that Mexico was no exception to. So these three issues really became like a very explosive political mix. On the other hand, there were three conditions of possibility for AMLO's landslide. The first of which was when Peña Nieto came to power, there was this thing called the Pacto por México, which was an agreement between party elites, you know, to push forward an agenda of modernizing reforms, which were, you know, in the agenda of Peña Nieto, but that opposition parties didn't really necessarily agree with, but they went on with it anyway. And this created, you know, sort of the impression that, you know, political parties were, you know, interchangeable. You know, particularly the leaders of the parties, their legitimacy was supposed to be in their capacity to represent the difference between their platforms, their electorates, their party members. And these differences were nowhere to be found at the beginning of Peña Nieto's term. So there was really the sense that the, you know, that the Mexico's transition to democracy party system was, you know, voiding itself of any significant meaning. The second thing was, you know, as a consequence of this, and as a consequence of the fact that the three main parties starting voting together in a lot of these reforms, the opposition parties lost credibility as opposition. The PRI was in government, the PAN and the PRD, you know, were supposed to be opposition parties, but were voting for the government. And López Obrador had left the PRD in 2012 and had, you know, a new project of a new party, which came into existence, I don't remember if it was 2014 or 2015, but he was pretty much out of the everyday political game, creating his own party. So he was, in a way, you know, outside of this crisis, party system crisis dynamic. And the third thing, the third condition of possibility was the fact that all of these reforms that were done, of course, there was a certain inflation of expectations, you know, because of the selling of the reforms in public opinion. But these, you know, together with, you know, one of the key elements of the Mexican transition to democracy was a gradualist reformism. You know, gradual reforms every now and then, and, you know, things will get better, will get better. And I think that with this last generation of reforms under Peña Nieto, people got fed up because the cost of the reforms was very evident, but the actual benefits were uncertain or ambiguous. So all of these conditions, together with the issues I just mentioned of violence, corruption, impunity, and economic injustice, ended up turning López Obrador into the only credible opposition candidate. You know, and the election was clearly an election about change. And there was nobody who can actually, like, credibly embody or, you know, give voice to the hopes of change, but López Obrador. López Obrador has been around. This was his third time as presidential candidate. He didn't win the first two times. He didn't recognize his defeats, but he certainly learned from them. And this time around, he was a much more practical, a much more conciliatory figure, and he ended up becoming like this great magnet for political discontent, you know, that ended up creating a historical result. He's the first president in the history of Mexican democracy who got an absolute majority of the popular vote and whose party got majorities in both houses.
And Carlos, you mentioned change. So how did AMLO promise change during the campaign and at the beginning of his tenure?
Well, the thing, I mean, López Obrador has been promising change for 20 years. He was a member of the PRI, you know, in his young years. Then he became a member of the PRD, the center-left party during the transition process. He was the leader of that party. He then became mayor of Mexico City between 2000 and 2005, and presidential candidate in 2006, 2012, and 2018. López Obrador, I mean, there's this saying in the US that I think applies wonderfully to López Obrador, which is, you know, a clock that has stopped working is right still twice a day. And in many ways, this happened with López Obrador. And the criticisms and the rhetoric that López Obrador has, you know, developed throughout the years about, number one, corruption, about what he calls the mafia in power, and about like the senseless violence and the war, you know, it just started making a lot of sense during the Peña Nieto years. And in electoral terms, I mean, López Obrador has had about 15 million loyal voters since 2006, and this time he had 30 million votes. So during the Peña Nieto years, he was able to persuade another 15 million voters. I think that on the one hand, it might be because he is a figure that's very antagonistic, very critical. He knows how to speak the language of disappointment in many ways. And what he promised basically was to eradicate corruption. I mean, we can go into, like, he has redefined what corruption means in Mexico in many ways. His vision of corruption is much moral or personal than policy-oriented or than institutional. But he has the merit of being a political figure in the midst of a political class that has been all been discredited because of corruption scandals. He is a political figure that nobody has been able to accuse of personally enriching himself, like from corruption schemes. So that was gold in this election. All parties, all groups, all politicians had one way or another a scandal that haunted them. López Obrador didn't. So in terms of corruption, he became a very important figure. Also in terms of economic injustice, you know, his motto was for the good of everybody, let the poor come first. Por el bien de todos, primero los pobres. And of course, in a country like Mexico, where this keen awareness of poverty and inequality, you know, grew exponentially during the last years, of course, this message resonated a lot with the Mexican public. And finally, he was an early critic of, you know, the security strategy or the war against drug cartels from the very beginning. And, you know, we've had enough evidence during these years that actually the way in which the Calderón administration waged war against organized crime, against drug cartels, actually produced more violence than it actually solved. Of course, López Obrador has taken this knowledge or this information to the extreme of assuming that then, you know, the solution might be not to exert force, which is kind of, you know, a bit too much. But anyways, his criticisms, his diagnosis of what was wrong with the country started making a lot of sense during the last 6 years, and that was the basis of his promise of change.
So as I mentioned up top, and as Carlos sort of just started getting into, one of the major areas where AMLO both made significant campaign promises and also faced significant challenges is Mexican economic policy. So Tony, how did AMLO specifically promise to improve the economy while on the campaign, and what has he delivered on and what is still outstanding?
Great, thank you. And it's great to be here. So in general, you know, AMLO's campaign promises, you know, have been fulfilled. In terms of the principal campaign promises, you know, increased GDP, increased minimum salary by 15%, it actually went to 16%, and formal employment also increased. No increase in taxes, however, taxes on savings and apps, phone apps have increased. He has respected the autonomy of the central bank, which has really stabilized the exchange rate and really this low historic inflation, about 3%. He's guaranteed youth employment, though the plan in motion has been met with skepticism by some. He has really tried to, you know, redo energy policy, you know, construction refineries in Dos Bocas, Paraíso, Tabasco, with quite a bit of investment. You know, he's tried to increase investment in infrastructure projects. However, the National Airport in Mexico City, which was the new Mexico airport, was canceled at a loss of about $13 billion. So there's been some, you know, quite a bit of contradictions in that. One of the things, despite some of these campaign promises having been fulfilled, it's really the way that they've been fulfilled that maybe you can kind of think a little bit more worrisome, at least in my mind. Some decisions have been made more out of political necessity than economic prowess, and really centered around one thing, and that's AMLO. So kind of the continuing of the weakness of the institutions. For example, in his most recent State of the Union address, he really said that income distribution will remain a priority over economic growth, kind of arguing that redistributing wealth is better. Government policy is able to help with economic development, help the poor. But again, there's no structural adjustments that have been able to do that. He's delivered very easy, quick wins. For example, stripping presidents of pensions, not using the presidential jet, although it's my understanding that it still has not been sold, so it's in the hangar and still paying quite a bit monthly on the lease. And really opened up Los Pinos, which, as you know, is like the Mexican White House, the Blair House, the executive office building all in one, to the public. But this has really impacted public perception, and that's why he has over 60% approval rating. And a poll done by El Universal a couple of months ago indicated that over 51% of citizens really view the actual situation, both personal and family, as much better than it did before AMLO took office. I think it's about an increase of about 9%. Again, it's this perception that people are really kind of focusing in on.
And one of his campaign promises that was a little more specific was a 4% GDP growth each year. What would that have looked like for the average Mexican, and what did the growth that actually happened this year mean for Mexicans?
Well, I mean, employment generation, you know, has been weak, about 35,000 plus jobs every month, which is actually less than Peña Nieto's first year in office, you know, which kind of think back is kind of worrisome a little bit on the economy. But the reason you've had these employment generation is, you know, you have had some stabilization in the in inflation, exchange rate, you know, together with an increase in salaries can generate a perception of well-being. You know, global commerce has had a bit of a slow rhythm and a deceleration in the economy. Mexico did pass legislation for the U.S.-Mexico kind of free trade agreement. We're still waiting for the Canadians and the U.S., and hopefully, you know, that will help a bit getting things started. Although PricewaterhouseCoopers did a survey a few months ago where 42% thought that the economy was on the right track, yet this represents a little decrease in confidence, because the same time last year in a 2018 survey, 57% were optimistic. There's a lot of overregulation in business, and there's a lot of uncertainty, which means evident when asked where Mexicans concentrate their investments, and it's mostly in the U.S. and some China as well.
Right. And speaking of investments, we've heard a lot of members of the private sector in Mexico express concern over his proposed economic policies or his style. What are those concerns, and are they founded? That's for you, Tony, but also
okay,
Carlos, if you'd like to answer as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I said, it's the lack of confidence, the weakening of the institutions that really have been kind of hurting, because everything is being concentrated around political or politics. So that's a very, very grave concern. One issue that, you know, for example, the 2020 budget is also of concern. So it was passed, what, November 22nd, 23rd, the 2020 budget. One of the things that is what that was, even though there's a 0.8 increase over last year, one of the concerns was some of the autonomous entities suffered the most cuts, in particular the Federal Commission for Economic Competition, the National Institute for Telecommunications, and I think most controversial a list for folks in our line of work is the cut, I think the largest in its history since 2014, of the National Electoral Institute, and given because of the political implications. You know, INE, you know, we've worked a lot, at least as IRI, we've worked quite a bit on electoral observations around the world, and we've actually used INE as kind of a sharing of best practices, lessons learned around the world. The latest one was El Salvador, actually, where we brought in folks from INE to the TSC to kind of learn some best practices in how they did do an election day. They're a very highly regarded institution, characterized by its values, independence, autonomy. You know, so this is quite worrisome, particularly given the 2020 midterm federal elections that will renew completely the Congress, which, as Carlos mentioned, you know, Morena has, you know, the majority in both houses. So this is something that's actually very worrisome. And actually, the president of INE is in town this week, kind of making the rounds, talking about his concerns.
Carlos, did you have anything? Great. So another question. So Mexico has ratified USMCA. It's currently pending ratification here and in Canada. So if it's ratified by all three countries, how would this impact the Mexican economy? And if not, how do you think that AMLO could respond to a potential renegotiation?
Well, I mean, I think a U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement will definitely strengthen the Mexican economy, obviously that of all overall of North America. It was in need of an update, if you will. I think AMLO is also tempered by a modernizing Mexico that has largely embraced and is dependent upon a free market economy, obviously integrated with the U.S. You know, I don't think AMLO is an internationalist by nature, but he recognizes kind of Mexico's leading role. It's the 11th largest economy in the world, 15th largest exporter. It leads the world in free trade agreements, and especially relying on economic links with the United States. So I think it's something very important to keep in mind. And 80% of Mexico's exports goes to the United States, and more than 40% of foreign investment originates from American companies. So NAFTA is important. NAFTA, the way that it's been renegotiated, I think has and will have the support from the Democrats, because a lot of the issues that they are concerned about, you can kind of see reflected in this agreement, which I think is very positive. So I think it'll definitely should get passed. If it doesn't, there'll be a lot of a big business crisis around North America, because it will not only impact Mexico, but the United States as well. I mean, you know, and also the U.S. elections will also impact Mexico, something to think about as well. But I think that the trade agreement should be first and foremost on the top of the political agenda for all those countries involved.
So as we've already sort of touched on, security issues were a major topic of the campaign last year. So Rebecca, how did AMLO promise to improve the security situation in Mexico, and has he succeeded with any of those promises?
Unfortunately, this is an area of really bad news. So during the campaign, AMLO promised to address the security crisis. Carlos, you mentioned how grave it was. He also promised to do so without relying on the military. This was your point about Calderon calling the military in 2006 and UNMLO was very critical because of the rise in human rights abuses, extrajudicial killings, disappearances. So he also pledged to kind of get the military off of the streets and strengthen the police. I will say, though, on his behalf, your point about the diagnosis, I do agree with AMLO's point about the necessity to address the root causes of the violence. You know, he talked about poverty eradication, employment, educational opportunities, prevention programs for at-risk youth. I think these are all wonderful ideas, but they're going to take a long time. They're going to require tremendous resources and sustained focus. And in the meantime, we still have this crisis in Mexico. And so the public security crisis is graver than ever. The military is still on the streets, and there's been no significant progress when it comes to police reform. So as far as the actual security situation today, so homicides are on track to reach a record high for the second year in a row. The events in Culiacan and the massacre of the Mormon family in Sonora really kind of highlighted this. Situations over the weekend, the shootings in Villa Union near the border with Texas. So, you know, there's great celebrations about the one-year anniversary while there is this massive incident of cartel violence. And also there were the protests in Mexico City over the weekend about the violence. 50% of Mexicans, this is according to the Latin American Public Opinion poll out of Vanderbilt University, 50% of Mexicans feel unsafe in their neighborhood. 20% feel that they have to move. 56%, and this is from October, 56% of Mexicans report that the AMLO security strategy is failing, his national plan for peace and security. And really troubling, 56% of Mexicans report that organized crime is actually stronger than the government. So these are not great. This is not good news. As far as the militarization of law enforcement in Mexico, once AMLO was in office, he was pretty quick to recognize that he said this is a bitter reality, the federal police is not prepared. So he did not call the troops off the streets. And what he did is he created this National Guard, which I'm sure most folks here are tracking, which in theory was going to kind of diminish reliance on the military. And the idea was that in five years, once the National Guard is fully operational, then he can call the military off of the streets. But the fact is that the National Guard itself is a militarized institution. It's comprised of members of Sedena, CEMAR. There are members of the federal police, but both Sedena and CEMAR, the Mexican Army and the Mexican Navy, are part of this institution. So it's hybrid. The head is, there was a lot of debate about this new National Guard. Human rights groups were really concerned. So when the constitutional amendment was passed, they did, rather than have the Ministry of Defense in charge of it, a civilian is in charge. It's the Secretary of Security and Civilian Protection. However, if you look at the makeup of the National Guard, most top commanders are indeed members of the military. And also, as something to note about the National Guard. I mean, it was created to address the public security crisis, but President Trump placed a lot of pressure on the Mexican government, on AMLO, to address the migration crisis from the Northern Triangle, and he threatened to place significant tariffs on Mexican goods. And in exchange, in order to not place the tariffs on the Mexican goods, AMLO promised to send 6,000 National Guard members to patrol Mexico's southern border, in particular the border with Guatemala, to stop Central American migrants. So again, the plan was to send the National Guard to the most violent parts of the country, and instead we see 6,000 troops diverted to the southern border. And then finally, what I'll say is on the police reform, is the campaign talked a lot about strengthening civilian law enforcement, but the plan, if you look at the actual plan, the National Security Plan for Peace and Security, police reform does not figure heavily in the plan, and there is really no detailed off-ramp to get the military off the streets.
And how does his security policy compare to that of his predecessors, specifically Calderón and Peña Nieto?
So what we're really seeing is it's not much of a change. In fact, the National Guard has a lot in common with Peña Nieto's gendarmerie. In 2014, Peña Nieto proposed or actually started this gendarmerie, which in many ways looks a lot like the National Guard, but that really fizzled off pretty quickly. Again, the reliance on the military continues to be a central part of the strategy, and it's kind of facing some of the same problems that it did under both Peña Nieto and Calderón.
Right. And you mentioned that the National Guard had significant criticism from human rights groups when it was created. Could you elaborate on why that was and sort of the backstory and the history?
Sure. So in large part because it is a very militarized force, the human rights groups in Mexico have for a long time expressed great concern about the role of the military in law enforcement, in particular the rise in human rights abuses by members of the military. So it comes from that history of human rights abuses, and again the failure to build up the federal civilian police.
And as Rebecca mentioned, Mexico is on its way to have one of its most violent years in certainly the last decade. So Gladys, can you explain to us a little bit about why that is? What's behind that uptick?
Sure. And thanks for having me. I think, you know, there's a series of reasons why 2019 is on track to break all records since the Mexican government's been keeping records, right? And it's in part because of the crisis that AMLO inherited back in December 1st of 2018. It's also, I mean, you know, he inherited something that was years of mismanagement and sort of the growth of the drug war and so on. So there's certainly some of that. But what we also can agree on is that he hasn't helped himself. And this sort of piggybacks off of what Rebecca was saying, that over the course of this year, the security policies that have been coming out from the security cabinet have really been anemic, to say the least. And there's been a lot of posturing, a lot of what's known as the soft policies, which are sort of poverty alleviation, that won't necessarily net results for a while. And I think the absence of the National Guard is more of a short-term fix has basically meant that the crisis has just continually worsened over the past 12 months. A few points that I wanted to make, and again, I appreciate sort of being able to build off of what Rebecca put on the table, is that, you know, sort of seeing this from the perspective of drug trafficking organizations and organized criminal networks throughout Mexico, I think the situation in Culiacán on October 17th was very revealing to all of them. Because basically, this was the day that's in Culiacán, which is a city of about 1 million people. It's the capital city of the state of Sinaloa. Like, this is the place where the National Guard should have been present, and they weren't necessarily there in the numbers that they ought to have for what was essentially the capturing of potentially two, at least one of El Chapo's sons who are sort of on the books as being part of the membership or the leadership of the Sinaloa cartel. And as many folks in the audience, I'm sure you know, they actually did capture Ovidio Guzman, which is the youngest of the sons. And then within hours, you had, I think, about 375 armored vehicles just descend from the mountains or, you know, all the sicarios and just a firefight that was sort of similar to what you would see on the movies, Unleashed Hell. And, you know, within hours, they had to release Ovidio Guzman just to, quote unquote, prevent further deaths. So it was clear that the government was outnumbered, outpowered, and if you show up with enough ammunition and enough firepower, you can actually bend the government to your will. So I think that was something that was very much of a clear message to organized criminal networks. The other thing that we've seen over the last 12 months, and AMLO has done nothing to sort of address it from a security standpoint, is just the expansion of organized criminal networks. So since 2006, you know, nowadays we're talking, you know, we started with six large cartels. Today we have about nine. We have about 24 medium-sized ones, and we have upwards of, I think it's 236 smaller organized criminal networks. And that was a number that was just released by Lantia Consultores just a couple weeks ago. So you really see kind of the expansion of organized crime in parts of Mexico. And what you see with some of the ones at the top, like the top players and some of the medium players, is that they have diversified their portfolios. These are transnational criminal corporations, right? So they are delving more into synthetics such as fentanyl and just sort of, you know, kind of a range of other activities, including human trafficking, sex trafficking, and so on, as a way to sort of move beyond just drugs. The other thing that I think is sort of a harbinger, kind of a storm in the horizon, is that, you know, just recently they've also discovered that there's been fields of coca plantations in southern Mexico. So this sort of evolution of drug trafficking organizations from just trafficking, who are now actually producing cocaine in southern Mexico, is actually quite scary. The other point that I wanted to make quickly is more about kind of these sort of medium slash smaller organized criminal networks that really ought to be the focus of AMLO's security policies, in part because, for example, the rates of extortion in Mexico, what they call derecho de piso, are just going through the roof in the last 12 months. So places such as, for example, Celaya in Guanajuato and elsewhere have just really come under the gun from some of these sort of smaller organized criminal networks, some of which actually have connections to the larger ones, just demanding extortion fees. And that's really just wreaked havoc in the lives of many more Mexicans than those who were just involved in the drug trade. And we don't see anything coming out of AMLO's administration to sort of address kind of the effects of extortion on some of these sort of populations, which just recently had actually been doing quite well. And it's actually then sort of, you know, triggered kind of a wave of sort of growing insecurity and violence in other places that had just recently, again, been safe. And I'm thinking here, for example, San Miguel de Allende, which, you know, for many of us sort of here in the U.S. is sort of a haven for expats, right? The other thing that, you know, we're sort of seeing is that these sorts of, you know, kind of more homegrown sort of domestic forms of organized criminal networks, it's easier because they don't have to expend that much capital, much money. They can reap sort of relatively quick sort of rewards and, you know, it kind of keeps them local. So I think some of the effects of organized crime are actually going to get worse in 2020. And I think what's sort of distressing to me, as well as I would imagine others on the panel, is that we're not really seeing AMLO kind of step up in terms of sort of shaking up his security cabinet to address some of these concerns. Rather, what he's continuing to do is to blame previous presidents, blame others. So, for example, in the case of Culiacán, he was actually demanding just a couple of weeks ago, demanding that members of the press actually apologize to his security cabinet because he felt that they had done a stellar job with the catch and release of Ovidio Guzman. So he's very much sticking to his line. And I think that line of hubris is just, to me, it's actually rather worrisome.
Of course, yeah, please.
I just wanted to take on something that you said, Gladys, because I think yes. This has been, you know, this has been part of the discussion for quite a while. You know, there's been a lot of criticisms about security policy for at least a decade. And there was always this question about what a leftist security policy would look like, because most of the criticisms came from the left of the political spectrum. And I think AMLO came up with this idea of, you know, attacking the social roots of the problem, you know, with a battery of social policy programs, with an increase in budget for social policy. But I think it's become quite evident at this point that social policy is not and cannot be a substitute for security policy. It might be a complement in the long run. And, you know, a big if, you know, there in between is if the policy is well designed and well implemented, which in the case of this administration is a big if, because, you know, we know there hasn't been a lot of evidence informing the design of these social policy programs, and then not even like regular rules of operation, you know, for this money to be spent the way it's supposed to spend, like rules of, you know, the quality of spending have not been put in place. So there is this sense on the one hand that, you know, maybe morally speaking or from the perspective of the left, it's great that the president is concerned, you know, to attack the social roots of the problem. But, you know, the fact that you're spending, you know, money on, you know, youngsters in order for them not to become sicarios or to become drug dealers. You know, if the money is well spent, you will see the results in 5-10 years. But in the meantime, that does nothing to address, you know, the massacres of the violence going on as we speak in the country. And I think, you know, what you're saying about, you know, López Obrador, you know, besides the hubris you were talking about, is the lack of an actual policy to address the current violence that is taking place.
I agree. And I think, you know, it's interesting for those of you in the audience who don't know, this policy has been nicknamed Abrazos No Balazos, so hugs, not bullets. And I think it was very catchy, especially at the beginning. But I think going in 12 months, and especially what's been going on in the last 2 months with all the massacres, including the one just yesterday in Villa Unión with 22 people dead, sort of suggests that this is very much of an immediate thing. And, you know, for the Abrazos No Balazos policies to have worked, it needed to actually have been in place about 10 years ago. And I think, you know, sort of the fact that it's not actually being kind of combined. But even for some of those, like, for example, even in Culiacán, you know, just a few months ago, AMLO had been there sort of promising building soccer fields and all sorts of poverty alleviation programs. But there had been no delivery in terms of actual funds for some of those projects. So what we're seeing is there's just a great deal of emphasis on the rhetoric. And not, again, not to sort of follow up on what you're saying, not the follow through of what this means on paper. And I think that's been something that's sort of held steady throughout, which brings into question the credibility of AMLO as being a, quote, leftist. And if anything, he's much more of a populist, if you want to think about it as such, in part because those are, you know, it's all about kind of keeping the relationships.
And just thank you. And just to kind of add to that is also kind of the issue of the rule of law and the lagging of the new justice reforms and the implementation of the new justice reforms that were put into place in 2016. So very, very much uneven across all 32 states, and impunity still runs high. So citizens are seeing this and they're saying, well, is security a crime? Is it a major issue for the government? Because my perpetrators are still not being caught or done anything, being, you know, kind of helping to put them in jail. So that's just something to keep in mind as well.
Definitely. And I think, you know, it'll be interesting to hear perhaps, you know, just later on, there's been some criticism that the security policy as such seems that he's almost sort of taking on this sort of managerial style of being the micromanager, like he wants to sort of, you know, have it in control, centralized under his management. And it doesn't necessarily work in practice. So, of course, you know, at some point, maybe later on, we can talk about the designation of some of these organized criminal networks as terrorist organizations. But I'll sort of set that aside.
That's great. Actually, yeah, we can certainly speak about that. But before we get into that, so his approval ratings have stayed pretty high throughout this first year, but they dropped about 10 points during this surge of violence that Gladys, you just discussed. Do you think that this will force him to make changes to his security plan? And if not, is there something that will?
I would certainly hope, just because, again, the fact that it dipped below 60% was very telling. It hit 58%. But there was another statistic that just came out a couple days ago, which said that despite the fact that 58%, you know, in terms of the approval rating, that 72% of people actually think that AMLO has done good this past year. And they cite the way in which he's attacked issues of corruption as being the number one reason why he thinks he's done so well, right? So again, this sort of, you know, comes back to what several of the panelists have already put on the table, which is there's been a lot of sort of showmanship with issues of the plane, cutting the salary in half, and so on. So we'll sort of, I think this might actually have bought him some time before he sort of held much more to account. So if anything, I would sort of suspect that there might be a slight bounce back from 58%. We're going to go back up into the 60% range, as long as there's no sort of more major massacres happening that would sort of deflect attention. So I guess we'll see.
Yeah, and I would like to talk a little bit more about the U.S. response to the security situation in Mexico. So this is both for Gladys and Rebecca and Tony and Carlos, if you'd like to jump in. Where can the U.S. play a positive role in assisting Mexico in mitigating violence? But then on the flip side, sort of what is the conversation here in the U.S. about sort of maybe designating, and in Mexico about like designating the cartels as terrorist groups?
Okay. Rebecca, you go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, as far as positive steps, things that the U.S. could do, I think that the number one thing we could do is kind of focus on the rule of law, working with Mexico to help them strengthen the rule of law particularly through judicial reform. I think that something we hear a lot about, and when there was the call between AMLO and Trump after the events in Culiacan, and they talked about finally doing something to slow the flow of illegal weapons or weapons from the United States into Mexico. Trump said, yes, we're going to do something about this. I don't think that's going to happen, unfortunately. I mean, 70% of guns that are seized in Mexico can be traced back to the U.S., mainly from southwest border states, primarily from Texas. During that phone call, they talked about technology, ways to use better technology to detect them. But as long as it's so easy to get guns and sell them to straw men, it's going to remain a problem. The labeling Mexican cartels as terrorist organizations, I have a very cynical view of this. I think it's about the campaign. This is, we're running up on the presidential campaign here, so the timing is not a coincidence. You know, I think it's a way for Trump to rev up his base. Villainizing Mexico in the past has worked well for him. Using racially charged language helped a lot in the last election. And his tweets, he recently tweeted, I'm sure, again, many of you saw this, it's time that the U.S. help Mexico wage war on the drug cartels and wipe them off the face of the earth. It's kind of reminiscent of the call he had with Peña Nieto when he said, you've got some bad hombres down there. Your military, is apparently not up to the task. I'm thinking about sending our military down. So for one thing, I think this is going to hurt our bilateral relationship. Another is just a problem with the definition. The State Department definition of a foreign terrorist organization, they're motivated by politics, they're politically motivated. The organizations that he's talking about in Mexico are motivated by profit. I think this is also could hurt the Mexican economy. I mean, we're already, the reports of violence in the U.S. newspapers, we read about what happened in Culiacan. Gladys, the very dramatic events that you so well described. But it's going to deter investment, tourism. And just though on the, there is perhaps a silver lining on this. I'm sure that this is not something that President Trump thought through when he mentioned this idea of labeling Mexican cartels as terrorist organizations, is that it could make a better case for asylum seekers from Mexico. That perhaps a silver lining. It also, I think, undermines the Remain in Mexico policy. Mm-hmm. That while asylum seekers are waiting for their cases to be heard in the U.S., they have to safely wait in Mexico. And
not,
I think it's
not a third safe country.
Not a third, yes. And it also, I think, undermines the safe third country agreements, because the cartels have reach into Central America. And finally, the NRA probably hasn't thought about this, but this could make it easier to charge the middlemen, the straw purchasers that are buying guns along the border, because they would be aiding and assisting a terrorist organization.
Yeah, and I think just to sort of build on what Rebecca was saying, I think it was there was a report saying that at the massacre of the LeBaron family members in Sonora, that all of the spent cartridges and the bullets had been purchased illegally in the U.S. and sort of transferred to Mexico. So it gives you a sense of how widespread the amount of ammunitions are happening down there. I think in terms of sort of the terrorist designation, so it seems right now there's only three that are on the chopping block, right? El Cartel Jalisco Nueva Generación, El Cartel del Golfo, and then El Cartel del Noreste, which is affiliated with Los Zetas. So it just, there's a lot of details that have yet to be hammered out. And I know that there's talk of William Barr going down to Mexico later this week. To sort of talk with Marcelo Ebrard, to sort of work out what this designation is going to mean. So I think once that meeting happens, we'll have a clear sense of what the Trump White House is intending to do with this designation. So right now in Mexico, there's a great deal of concern about the fact that this might be an affront to sovereignty and it's sort of a precursor for armed intervention. So Lopez Obrador just this morning was actually saying that the U.S. military is not welcome in Mexico. So I think we're already kind of getting a sense of how this is being perceived by AMLO and the administration, and they're going to be somewhat antagonistic to what William Barr sort of putting on the table, if it's sort of akin to what the, you know, that Trump tweet with the war in the caps, right? Wage war. But I think it's interesting to sort of think about how this designation of terrorist organization has been used in the past. Because, for example, in the case of Ireland with the IRA, with the Irish Republican Army, it was actually seen as an act of solidarity. So for that time and that experience and other cases as well, it's actually sort of helped sort of diplomatic ties between countries. But what I think what we're seeing here in the Mexican case is that it isn't that, that it has much more of a bellicose a sort of sound to it. Rebecca and Linnea, I think is it okay if I sort of talk a little bit about the Remain in Mexico policy?
Yeah, actually, that was my next question.
Oh,
so great.
Great. I think, you know, there's been such dramatic changes to asylum and sort of the asylum process here in the U.S. That I would hope that it would actually sort of help some of the asylum seekers. But the ways in which MPP was put into place, which is, you know, commonly referred to as Remain in Mexico, has really sort of undermined what could potentially have been. So, for example, if we look at asylum law, it would work. But the rollout of MPP in the last 12 months is basically precluding the fact that people could, in fact, use some of this designation to sort of help their asylum cases, in part because of the third country rule, right? And you now have sort of a backlog in terms of sort of individuals at the border. So I think there are estimates that right now there's about 50,000 people that are sort of hunkered down in six cities across the border just waiting for their asylum petitions. And just in the last 12 months, they've only granted 11 asylum petitions. So it gives you a sense of you know, it's just completely undone the asylum process here in the United States, and it's setting up Mexico for humanitarian crisis. So in terms of what to do, and I think, you know, again, sort of these migrants who are sort of located on the border are experiencing abuses both from drug trafficking organizations who are sort of using them for kidnapping, right? So the rates of kidnapping in some of these populations is just astronomical, most of which are actually happening in these six cities. They're also sort of subject to abuse by members of law enforcement, the security apparatuses, as well as even individuals who are sort of government officials who are with the immigration services in Mexico. So, you know, there's no sort of clear end to what this program is going to be. And I think undeniably, you know, as more stacking up of individuals coming up to the border zone, that migration, that it's going to become a much greater humanitarian crisis. And I think there's word now coming from some of these camps where these individuals are housed that the conditions in these camps are catastrophic. Like, it's much better to be in Syria than it is to be in Mexico. So I think if anything, AMLO should actually reach out to international community like the International Red Cross, the United Nations for help, in part because the United States, the monies that they're sort of offering is doing nothing as far as sort of addressing the humanitarian crisis. So I think that's sort of a very kind of critical point in terms of thinking about where next. And then the last point that I wanted to sort of issue is that we haven't talked about the Merida Initiative. And I think that's, you know, we already have sort of something in the books that if we were to dedicate funding to the Merida Initiative, much more realistically speaking, we would be able to sort of address issues of impunity and corruption on the ground. So that, you know, we have those sorts of protocols already established in terms of bilateral relationships. We just need the funds.
Great. And all of you have, including Gladys just now, have brought up issues of impunity and corruption and rule of law in Mexico. And there have been calls for sort of a CSIG-like structure in Mexico. And this is for the whole group. I mean, is this feasible? What would it look like? Does, you know, how much of it already exists within maybe Merida, for example?
Let me jump into that and take a little step back, because I think it's important to realize that, I mean, something that, Tony, you mentioned in passing, but I think, you know, it's important for this discussion and for the rule of law question, which is, you know, there is this impression, and I think it's the right one, that López Obrador has somehow undermined political institutions, on the one hand by reducing their budget, you know, also by appointing, you know, loyals to his cause, to his party, instead of people, you know, with the expertise or with the experience to head them. and you know, with the cuts and all. But I think it's important to realize that, you know, when we come to this threshold, the first year of López Obrador, and we ask ourselves, well, you know, he has obviously been a president who has tried to you know, to build a strong presidency, you know, and we have this irony or this dissonance of, you know, one year after, what we have is a strong presidency or stronger presidency but a weaker government. And one of the reasons of this has to do with institutions. And if you look at what has been the most important or the most efficient check that the López Obrador presidency has faced during this year, it is not Congress. It is not the Supreme Court. It is not the press. It is not civil society. It is not the so-called markets or the private sector. It's a relationship with the United States. López Obrador has this thing, you know, he talks a lot, and somehow he warns you way in advance of what he's going to do. It's still, you know, there's room for surprise because I can't believe he did this. But, you know, he told us he was going to do it 6 months ago. But if there's one instance where that has not been the case, is their relationship with the U.S. And I think the most important example in this regard is, you know, Mexico's migration policy in its southern border. You know, when AMLO came in, he had this proposal, you know, of a more humanitarian, a more just, a more open migration policy regarding Central American migrants. And when this policy regarding Mexico's southern border started creating conflicts in its northern border with the United States, and with Trump openly threatened to impose the tariffs, you know, Gladys was talking about, if Mexico didn't do significantly more to address these, you know, new migration flows, AMLO had to eat his words and to radically change his policy towards Central America, even devoting some of the resources that were being created to fight narcos to hunt down immigrants. So what I'm wondering about this, you know, this comment, it's not an open threat yet, but the comment about labeling Mexican drug cartels as terrorist organizations, my impression is that, you know, that Trump is not going to go through with it. I think this is electorally motivated, but also politically motivated. He has done this before. He, you know, he launches a threat and then waits to see how Mexico reacts. And Mexico, you know, the reaction in Mexico has been very public opinion oriented, saying, you know, we're a sovereign country, you know, the American army is not welcome. But I wonder to what extent in the private, you know, meetings that are going to take place next week, to what extent is the U.S. going to use this as, you know, as a weapon to have Mexico change, as it changed its migration policy regarding the southern border, change its security policy, particularly this idea that, you know, we're not going to wage war against the cartels anymore. No, I mean, and after what happened with the Levarón family and all these massacres, of course, the idea of hogs, not bullets, sounds, well, frankly, grotesque. So it is a very propitious moment for the U.S. to exert some pressure on the López Obrador government to actually, you know, force it to change its security policy.
Well, in terms of corruption, and you had mentioned, you know, Mexican CSIG, CS, AMAQI, whatever you want to label it, we got to keep in mind that Mexico does have the National Anti-Corruption System, the SNA, which has kind of helped serve as a multiplier between the government and civil society to kind of get at the root causes of corruption. But what AMLO did in one of his first appointments was actually name one of his close confidants as the anti-corruption czar, if you will, close to AMLO. But the SNA has not really received or strengthened budget, and it has really been hampered. And more the financial intelligence unit has been sort of the mechanism that has been focused on corruption via the follow the money model, if you will. But there's no criteria for investigation. Do they go after the opposition? Is it a social good? There have only been investigations, but really no judicial process has been started. The perception is that corruption is the main issue. It's been delivered to, you know, to an audience, but there's no really systemic change has been taking place, or whatever change there is kind of questionable. And as Carlos was saying, you know, there's been a sidelining of institution, which really weakens the processes and offers AMLO as the messiah, if you will, as the only one that can really solve the problem. But the thing is here, there is really no sustainability to that. It's if it's just kind of based on one person instead of an institution.
Can I just add to Carlos your point about if I think it's a really interesting hypothesis you put out there, and I wouldn't surprise me at all. And if that is the case, if in these private discussions there's pressure to implement a new security strategy, I hope it's not a return to the kingpin strategy. Because, I mean, that was, I think, the idea that go after the leader of the cartel, that's the solution. And we all know from Colombia, but also from Mexico, and Gladys, your description of how these number of cartels has grown and how they're morphed, how they're these very slippery beings, we see that largely, we see that when we go after the heads of cartels and they fragment and they become even more violent.
Great, so I wanna leave some time for audience questions, but I have one more question for all four of you. Lopez Obrador has 5 more years in office. What should he prioritize in order for those 5 years to really be successful?
Nobody wants to answer.
No one wants to answer. Or better, sort of, in Mexico, sir. Oh, yeah, go ahead, if you have.
Yes. I'm sorry, I thought we were going in order.
No, sorry.
My bad. No, well, obviously, you know, Mexico is extremely important to the U.S., and it's a regional leader. And I think AMLO, you know, should try and use his popularity, if you will, to really help strengthen the democratic principles, institutions, clamp down on corruption by strengthening the SNA. I think that will be a step in the right direction, and kind of working with the opposition to try to move, you know, the country forward. There was, you know, Morena's kind of hold on power will not really, you know, last for forever. There was a survey last week, I don't know if any of you saw, in El Universal, which released the popularity of Morena along with the PAN, with the PRI, and the PRD is really in low repute. And in that order, the poll suggesting that if the, you know, elections were now, you know, Morena would get about 36%. They received about 48% or plus last go around. A further indication that the political party system and its institutions in Mexico continues to be in crisis. And you really need to strengthen that democratic processes and commitments, you know, so that, you know, Mexico can really open up. I think that would be something to keep in mind.
I would hope, what I think the priority should be, I don't think it will be, is strengthening the rule of law. Gladys, you mentioned that AMLO is a populist, and populists tend not to like strong checks on their power. So unfortunately, I don't see that as likely to be a priority. I wish it would be. In the security space, I think that really kind of going back and focusing on reform of the civilian law enforcement should be the focus.
Oh, Gladys?
So I think as far as what I would kind of sort of think in terms of these next 5 years, I think there needs to be more of a presence of international actors, right? So one of the things that was so different and distinct about CC in the case of Guatemala, and the reason why they were so successful, is in part because you had that affiliation with the United Nations to sort of really kind of lend credibility, give oversight, sort of address issues of impunity, and also sort of display some of the blame away from some of the domestic actors who might have some skin in the game to an international actor. So I think having more of a presence of outsiders, and here it could be United Nations, it could also to a certain extent be the OAS, to sort of come in and sort of help sort of boost some of the weak institutions in the country, you know, beginning with issues of law and order. Likewise, in terms of some of the immigration stuff, I'd mentioned, you know, the fact that we actually need to have some of these international actors come in and sort of address this growing humanitarian crisis. And I think, you know, what we're seeing with AMLO too, just recently, I know that there's been an expansion of some of the efforts between the Mexican government and, you know, by, for example, actually boosting the numbers of National Guard to both the southern border and the northern border. So I think right now there's about 13,000 members of the National Guard on the southern border and 15,000 on the northern border. Those individuals should not be there. They should be elsewhere in the country, sort of protecting citizens who are sort of currently on the front lines. And that sort of, you know, tacks back to issues of extortion, as well as what we sort of have seen in some of these major theaters, Guerrero, Michoacán, Tamaulipas, Coahuila, to sort of ensure kind of greater attention. So that would certainly be one. And then the last point that I would make would be that he needs to shake up his security cabinet. Some of those individuals are clearly not, you know, they don't bring sort of the specific skill set that's required to the scale and the magnitude of this crisis. So I would certainly hope that he would sort of revisit some of his choices to lead some of the agencies that are, again, on the front lines.
Well, I agree with the priorities, you know, fellow members of the panel have pointed out. So I'm going to add a new one to the list, which is redistribution. I think AMLO came into power with the idea, you know, because he sold himself as a man of the left, that, you know, Mexico needed a stronger state in order to redistribute wealth. But the thing is, you know, he damaged himself very significantly during the transition period, once he had won, but before he took power, by canceling a new airport for Mexico City that was already 30% built. And, you know, the cost of the termination cost of the new building, of the new airport, was around $13.5 billion. And not only is that money, you know, going down the drain, but it's also the signal that it sent to investors. And up to now, you know, the problem with Mexico, you know, is bordering on a recession. You know, the number one cause is the fact that there is very little certainty, very little trust in the private sector for investing. And if AMLO really wants to pursue his redistribution agenda, you know, there can't be, or, well, there can be, but it's a lot more hard to redistribute if there's no wealth. Politically speaking, it's just a recipe for conflict, you know. You know, a stronger, larger growth might be, you know, a bit easier to redistribute wealth, but if there's no growth, redistribution policies face a lot of resistance and challenges. So, you know, for me, a priority that might be, you know, in the cards for him is, you know, to really try to reconstruct trust and certainty for private investment and for the economy to start growing again, and for him to really, you know, be able to make some sort of difference in terms of the redistribution of wealth by the end of his term.
Wonderful. Well, I would like to open it up for questions to the audience. A couple of ground rules. One is, please wait for the microphone, speak into the microphone. If you could identify yourself before you ask your question. And finally, a question ends with a question mark. So, yeah, right over here. If you could wait for the microphone. Sorry.
My name is Jonathan. Really grateful for the panel for speaking. I'm a private tutor. My question is on the independence of the judiciary in Mexico. Now, does the judiciary, the, you know, Supreme Court justice, does he have independence, or is he co-opted by the executive, AMLO? Is it written in the Constitution? Is there constitutional enforcement?
You want to go ahead? Well, I think, unfortunately, the judiciary is in the process of becoming captured. The way in which Supreme Court justices are appointed, you know, renders itself for party negotiations and for quotas to be set. But now that Morena has a majority, and that there are other parties that, you know, are part of López Obrador's coalition, the appointments so far have been, you know, of people who are more or less close or loyal to Morena. But the really worrisome aspect has been that the Supreme Court has a president. And the new president, Arturo Saldívar, has been very vocal and very open, you know, to say that he supports López Obrador, that he shares with him ideas, that they're friends, something that is very, you know, that sounds very out of place from a justice president. So I think that, you know, it might still be too soon to say that it's not independent, but I think it's, you know, it's pretty standard to recognize that judicial power is in the process of being captured by the president's coalition.
Oh, I'm Barbara Bowie Whitman. I am a retired Foreign Service officer and served in Mexico City 30 years ago. And the question I'd like to ask has to do with this business of shutting down the construction on the airport. What was the major objective? Was it because it was into cost overruns? I mean, what positive results did he anticipate from it?
Well, I'll say my answer to that. I think it was meant to be a political signal that, you know, there's a new sheriff in town and that he was serious about it. He was not going to play politics with, you know, with business interests the way it used to be played before. Did it work? I think it was a very improvised, impetuous decision. Should be said that, you know, he wanted the airport to be canceled, but he called this sort of a, you know, referendum, on very shaky grounds, legally speaking. And, you know, all polls, or most polls, tended to show that the population was against canceling the airport. But in the end, the referendum, gave opposite results, and most people who participated were in for shutting down the airport. You know, studies have been conducted as to, you know, the voting booths were installed in places where of Morena's strongholds. So, you know, the results were very, like, had no legal value, but López Obrador used them to, you know, announce the decision that he was going to cancel it. In terms of public finances, it was a disaster. It cost so much money. Politically speaking, yes, I think it sent the signal that López Obrador was for real. Somehow, you know, in terms of game theory, this was like, you know, López Obrador tying himself, you know, to a post and saying, I'm real, this is real, I don't care to lose all this money, but, you know, I am a new sheriff in town, and he accused, you know, the project of being, you know, plagued by corruption. But 1 year after, there's no legal process and nobody has been put in jail, you know, for that corruption. This brings us to something that we barely touched upon, which is the fact that, you know, López Obrador has more than an anti-corruption policy. He plays anti-corruption politics. And he uses corruption or you know, accusations of corruption as a weapon against his enemies or against any sort of check and balance that he might have to reckon with. So, you know, to go back to your question, I think it was a gesture, you know, meaning to symbolize or to represent change in a way that has been, you know, a signature of his government. His government has been very worried to send a lot of signals and to talk a lot about change, to sort of symbolize change more than actually carrying it out.
You guys. Can I add something?
Please, yeah, go ahead.
So I think in addition to sort of sending a signal to the population at large, and especially his supporters, it was also meant as a clear signal to sort of the political establishment, right? So this was supposed to be sort of the pearl in the crown or the jewel in the crown for Enrique Peña Nieto. And, you know, he had invested so much, but this was Peña Nieto's legacy that AMLO was then supposed to continue. So this was a very, very clear signal to that political establishment that we're not going to put up with this. And to sort of like distance himself from, you know, sort of politics as usual and sort of set himself apart entirely. So it was, despite the fact that it came at a tremendous cost to everybody, and we have as of yet to sort of see any of the accusations of corruption kind of come to life. I think the capital that he was able to sort of get from having announced the elimination of Naim was huge.
Okay. Alejandro Grisanti, I am Venezuelan, and as a Venezuelan, I need to ask something about re-election. That AMLO will try to software the institutional framework in order to be re-elected. This is a theme that, in my personal thought, is usually the politicians, okay, used to spend a lot of time thinking on this and usually reach very late, okay, on the public opinion and on the analysis that we could have. I don't have I don't know if you can give me an opinion about the possibility of re-election, and if the, he will use the midterm election or any other time to try to push for that measure.
No, please.
Yeah, or just well, as the past year, I mean, we have seen some of the erosion of some of the institutions, and really kind of like Carlos was saying, kind of the capturing of the state in a lot of these areas. You've got you know, bids being done for contracts that are some pet projects for AMLO. You have this concentration in this one person. You have got the midterm elections. You've got the majority of Morena. I don't see in the short term, you know, in this sexenio, of being able to erode all that power. But it's certainly very concerning the way that some of the institutions have been are being weakened. But in terms of the next re-election, the next 6 years, I don't think so, unless he has that referendum and he puts forth. I mean, that could happen as it did in Bolivia. We all know how that turned out. But I don't see that happening so closely in the next 5 or 5 years.
So I agree, but I do see sort of, to me, in many ways, it looks like AMLO has taken a page out of the playbook of someone, I mean, maybe not as extreme as Chavez, but, you know, we've seen this in other Latin American countries. You mentioned Bolivia, from both the left and the right, Hernandez in Honduras, where you see this kind of slow, you know, you go after the judiciary, then you go, the press. I mean, we haven't really talked about his attacks on the press. So I do see sort of some of these troubling signs. I think of the sexenio as something so fundamental to Mexico. But then again, I would not have predicted this degree of, in just a year, for the power to become so concentrated in the executive branch.
I would add to that, too, that if, you know, depending on what happens with the midterm elections, we'll have a much clearer signal of what's going on. And then also we sort of start seeing a dramatic uptick in the use of referendums. So far, I actually sort of expected more. So I've been surprised with the lack of it. But I would sort of imagine that if we start sort of seeing that go up, that's going to be a very kind of clear indicator. The other thing that's different from Mexico, from some of the other countries that have sort of experienced this process, right, is that they don't have the neighbor to the north. So I think the U.S. government is less likely to sort of put up with sort of changes to the Constitution, to allow for re-election, especially if there's sort of concerns. So I think there's a much greater likelihood that the U.S. would actually sort of step in to kind of prevent this from happening or express concern, so to speak. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Sure. Right here in the middle, and then next will be our next two questions.
Hi, my name is Brian. I'm an undergraduate journalism student at Arizona State. I'm doing my senior undergraduate project on the effect of AMLO on the press in Mexico and kind of comparing it to Trump. So I was wondering, what has been the effect of AMLO on the press in Mexico, and what has been the impact of that on the country itself? How has the Mexican press really dealt with this, and how has the population really interpreted, you know, his daily press conferences that he carried over from his terms as mayor?
I'll take this one. Yeah. Well, you know, AMLO as a populist, you know, I think there's this distinction to be made. Sometimes, you know, the way in which these sort of strong leaders, you know, react to press coverage or to the media lead us to believe that they hate the media. But I don't think that's the case. I think populist leaders these days need the media and love the media. What they hate is journalism. I mean, it's the case with Trump, clearly, and with, you know, a number of European leaders. Because, you know, these days, populist leaderships are, you know, mediatic or non-existent. And they use the media, of course, as platforms for their message, for their sort of celebrity. But they don't like journalism because it puts them on the spot, and they don't like the scrutiny, and they don't like to have to deal with evidence, you know. I think it was not Trump, but Kellyanne Conway who coined the expression alternative facts, right? López Obrador has an equivalent, you know, when he's confronted with official data produced by his own government regarding employment creation or homicides or, you know, the lack of economic growth. He said, well, I have other data. So yes, since before AMLO, Mexico was one of the most dangerous countries for journalists. And since AMLO came to power, I think, well, the last I checked, it was 13 journalists who had been killed, which is, you know, a kind of sort of a deceptive number because, you know, we focus on the ones that have been killed, but others have, you know, been threatened or attacked or... and this has been a problem Mexico has had since way before AMLO, this should be said. But AMLO, I don't think, has done nearly enough to address the problem. And actually what he's done is, you know, he has weaponized the lack of credibility of a lot of the press, you know. For a long time in Mexico, one of the main sources of revenue for the press was what we in Spanish call official publicity. You know, the government buying ads on TV, on newspapers, on radio. And that created, of course, a very, you know, problematic relationship. You know, there was no Chinese wall, you know, between the commercial and the editorial department in most of these media outlets. So, you know, there was always this accusation to be made against the media of having been bought by you know, the money of official publicity. One of the good things that AMLO has done since he came to office, he reduced the budget for official publicity for more than half, which I think was good because, you know, it was unjustifiable to spend so much money on official publicity and it lent itself to this problematic relationship. But now what is happening is that AMLO and some of his supporters are using the very terms Mexicans used before, you know, to attack or to criticize the bot press. They're using it against the critical and the independent press that attacks or that criticizes AMLO. And what he does, and this is a novelty, he does it openly. You know, for instance, the scandal I mentioned about, you know, corruption and Peña Nieto's White House, where they end up firing the journalists that did the investigation, that was all done, you know, say, under the table, you know. But with López Obrador, what happens is that he uses this platform, the so-called mañanera, his morning press conferences, to speak up his mind. And he says, you know, I am a citizen. I am just using my right to freely express myself, which is, of course, absurd because he's the president. This is not a normal citizen, you know, expressing his opinion. This is somebody who has a platform using his power to send signals. And his followers, you know, are very, you know, they listen to what the signals are. So a lot of the journalists that criticize, or all the media outlets that criticize AMLO, or that make uncomfortable questions during these press conferences, of course, you know, for the rest of the day in social media, you know, are, you know, the objects of very systematic attacks. So the thing is, the situation of the press was not good before AMLO. But now what we're facing is, you know, sort of a different, like an additional level of a menace, which is not only the continuity of aggressions against journalists, but now the very president himself creating this sort of validation of the hostility environment against the press that, you know, reporters and journalists have had to face since many years ago.
Question right here. Yes, yeah.
Thank you. I'm Bill Veal. I have a question anyone on the panel could ask, could answer about the status of education reform in Mexico.
Anyone? Is there sort of anything more specific that you're really curious about?
Lo has been backtracking on things that his predecessor had done, particularly with the teachers union, and I'm wondering if there's any more news on that front and what may be going in, because we're talking about injustice and economic inequality, empowering people with education, a real education is an important part of the development of Mexico.
Well, in fact, Peña Nieto's education reform, which was one of the signatures of his term, has been eradicated. There has been a reform. And I mean, the most important aspect of it was, you know, one of the good things that the Peña Nieto reform did was take away the control of, you know, the teachers' careers from the unions and to put it in the control of the state. And there were tests, and there were whole procedures, like official procedures, for professors to have a professional horizon, so to speak. And that has been taken away. And the control of the teacher's career has been turned back to the unions this first year. That's one of the legacies of the first year of López Obrador.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you all for coming out, and please join me in thanking our panelists for being with us today.